Welcome to the Oral History Review at the Oxford University Press blog. Occasionally, we like to break up the monotony of text posts with a podcast, celebrate the oral and oral history, so to speak. With these podcasts, we hope to give the Oral History Review's authors and editors a place to elaborate on or build upon their scholarship. Furthermore, as with all of our social media efforts, we aim to build awareness of the art and craft of oral history. The following podcast is hosted by Troy Reeves, the Oral History Review's managing editor and head of the Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Enjoy.
Thanks, Caitlin. Today I'm speaking with Miles Harvey. Miles is a professor at DePaul University, author of several books, and he is the editor of How Long Will I Cry? Voices of Youth Violence. First off, Miles, thank you for agreeing to talk with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Troy. Thanks.
Miles, before we get talking specifically about the book, I wonder if you comment on any knowledge of or interest in oral history you had before the book.
Well, I've had a long history, long interest in oral history. From when I was a kid and saw Studs Terkel speak when I was an undergraduate at the University of Illinois, and I knew Terkel a little bit. I'd interviewed him twice, and one time my wife and I ran into him at a theater performance, and by that point he and I were friendly, and we gave him a ride home and went back to his house, and he made us Cosmopolitans all night, and I think it was Cosmopolitans anyway, some mixed drink, and we sat around and talked, and it was wonderful. I also love oral history as a narrative form, and you know, I have a background in journalism, but I teach what's called creative nonfiction, and I think it's a really useful teaching tool for a number of reasons. One being, I just think it focuses nonfiction writers on just the pureness of storytelling. When readers read other people's stories, spoken stories, I think it helps them think about getting at the pureness of storytelling. The other thing I think oral history does is it's really good. It frees up, when you're working with it, it frees you up to be a really wonderful editor when you have to do what Terkel called chiseling. He compared oral history interview to this block of granite, and then said the narrative comes like a sculptor chipping away at it, and I think that's really good. And the other thing I find really important and found really important about this project, How Long Will I Cry, is it got my creative writing students who are really well trained in storytelling but not so well trained in interviewing and research out in the world and talking to other people and interfacing with the world in a really intense and profound way.
So let's get to the book. And my first question is, if you wouldn't mind talking a bit about what led to your decision to address youth violence in Chicago in this way.
Well, I mean, we have a problem here with violence, as we're finding with this book, to a lot of other cities. We had 500 murders here last year, which was the most in the country. And in 2009, there was a particularly a brutal killing that brought a lot of infamy to Chicago. It was a kid named Darion Albert on the far south side of Chicago. He was beaten to death with lumber and then stomped with feet until he died. And some kid filmed this, was sort of laughing as it happened, and then posted it on the internet, and it went viral. And I think for a lot of people, that was a wake-up call. For me, it was just sort of a, it's not that I wasn't concerned about violence and I was completely ignorant of it here, but we do live in the most segregated city in the country. And for me, all of a sudden, there was this moment like, hey, that's my city. How can this happen? What can I do? And I just happened to have coffee with a friend, Hallie Gordon from Steppenwolf Theater, shortly after that. And we brainstormed, and Hallie was talking about how she wanted to do a documentary theater piece about youth violence, basically an oral history theater piece. But she didn't have the troops to go out and collect the stories, and this light bulb went off over my head, and I said, well, you know, I think I might be able to get the troops, and How Long Will I Cry was born there.
We oral historians talk about the importance of collaboration. A question I was going to ask about the theater piece, that collaboration started almost immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk about the power of collaborative storytelling, because I think that's been really a profound experience for me. You know, I'm an author and a longtime journalist, and I write short stories too, and I'm used to sort of doing things myself. This was a collaboration on so many different levels and really powerful. I did a talk the other day where I said I want to congratulate and thank all the authors in the room, and we had many of the collaborators in this room. I said, but it's going to take a long time because there are so many authors in this room. So we had this great collaboration with Steppenwolf Theater, the wonderful creative team there. And included on that creative team was Kelly Simpkins, who was one of the creators of the Laramie Project, which is just an amazing oral history-based play that's had all sorts of national and international success. And so I just learned a lot from the Steppenwolf people and a great group of actors. It was just an amazing experience. But also just working with my students, who are such great collaborators, and then working with all the people in the community, and the communities, I should say, who opened their lives and hearts to us. It was really a profound experience to travel all over the city. So, yeah, we had a collaboration from the start with Steppenwolf. Hallie and I had really not very ambitious plans for this at the start. I think we just talked about, well, maybe we can get a few monologues out of it. I don't even think she saw it as necessarily a play at Steppenwolf. And quickly, it became apparent that the material we were getting was just really extraordinary. Maybe to oral historians, not so extraordinary, but to everyone concerned with this project, we just quickly realized we not only did we have a play on our hands, but we had much more. And so we started looking for funding for a book.
Miles, as our editorial assistant, Caitlin, was doing some background research, she found out about a class that you now teach that has come from the book and the theater piece. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it can take different forms. I mean, we have a woman named Amy Tyson, a good oral historian at DePaul, and one of the things I tried to do, we didn't call it an oral history class because I tried not to step on anyone's toes or point myself oral historian because I know, you know, this is an academic job with, you know, with people really trained in a specific way. I'm a veteran journalist, so interviewing is something I'm very good at and something I can teach. And I've done some oral history before, and I really believe in the power of it. So it wasn't necessarily called an oral history class. I think I called it the art of the interview. But yeah, I was able to get the first ever creative writing and social engagement class at DePaul, which has now become a really thriving class, which morphs into different forms. And so I taught 2 years of that. So we collected these stories over the course of 2 years, and it was a really great experience. We brought in a lot of people. Alex Kotlowitz came and talked to the class. You know, just a bunch of people who were sort of better versed at this sort of storytelling than I am. So, yeah, I guess it was, in fact, an oral history class, but I wouldn't presume to be an oral history teacher.
You alluded to this, and you've talked quite a bit just in the few minutes that we've been together about the importance of oral history. I want to ask directly, though, how you feel that oral history specifically helps address the issue of youth violence in Chicago.
It's been powerful. I got to tell you, we got the first hint of it with the Steppenwolf play. For the first time ever, Steppenwolf toured. We not only did the run of the show at Steppenwolf, but we toured it through public library branches, many of them, most of them, in the affected areas, hard hit by violence. I was worried that we'd look out and see a bunch of kids rolling their eyes and saying, okay, thank you for this middle-aged white person. We see this outside our doors every day. Why are you bringing this back to us? In fact, we found in a powerful way that the opposite thing was happening, that kids were standing up afterwards and saying, that's not my story exactly, but that's my story. And they were making clear to us that they felt recognized by this theater piece. And I think the book has been even more powerful that way, partly because you don't have to go to it like you do with a play. It comes to you. We've set up this really exciting experiment in book publishing called Big Shoulders Books, where we got some funding. We're publishing How Long Will I Cry for free. It's a beautiful book, just as a physical object. It's getting amazing reviews, but the really exciting thing about it is we're getting requests from all over the country and all over the city, from people with violence in their families, people who've lost kids themselves, but also from teachers, members of the clergy, social workers, police, parole officers. It's just been amazing. And clearly the book is having impact. We printed 7,500 copies, which I thought was a crazy large amount. And in about 6 weeks, we've gone through all those copies. And so we're going to have to do a second printing. It's really having an impact. I think it's getting discussions started. I think people just recognize themselves in these stories and their neighborhoods in these stories.
Miles, is there one particular story or narrator that really stands out for you?
I mean, I think the range of narrators is really important. We wanted to talk to a lot of young people because we felt like this book would be useless without young people. And so there's some amazing stories in there. There's a kid we call Jaime who was trying to leave a gang. I think that's just a powerful narrative. He talks and expresses in ways he doesn't even know endlessly about the fear he feels. He's hiding in Chicago from the gang he was in. But he also talks about the power he felt in a gang. There's other stories. There's an amazingly articulate kid named Deshaun McKnight who comes from a very powerful gang family in Chicago who is now outside of gangs. But he talks about getting a gun at 13. But we also talk to other people affected by it, not only family members. I think some of the most powerful stories are from family members, but also people like an emergency room nurse at Stroger Hospital, where most of the gunshot wounds in the city are taken. We talk to the county coroner. We talk to a funeral home director, the people who deal with these shot up kids. I think those are some of the most powerful narratives in the book. We really wanted to get a range of stories. And we made a conscious decision not just to do one neighborhood, but to go to people all over the city. And that made it for a very difficult narrative for the play. But for the book, I think it's had the power of giving people across the city a feeling like they're not alone, that they're in this together.
I have one more question. That question is, earlier you said that other cities, you found out that other cities have similar issues. So people from other cities have reached out to you after the play and the book?
Yeah, with Big Shoulders Books, we ask people to do something about violence. We ask people who have money to give money to, so that we don't consider the book free. We think that books are more valuable than their sticker price, not less valuable. So we ask something of people, and the bare minimum we ask is that you give us a narrative. So if you go on to our website, bigshouldersbooks.com, we ask that you tell a story about why you want the book. And these stories, some of them are just so incredibly powerful. But we are getting blitzed from all over the country with people struggling with violence and having a tool at their disposal to open discussions about this. And they are realizing that kids are into this book. And that's one of the most rewarding things for me. You know, I got a call from a guy the other day who works in a group in town that works with at-risk kids, and he said he brought in a copy of the book and read one of the narratives to him. And he looks up, and these young men are saying, "Where can we get this book?" And they've never expressed any interest in getting a book before. And we get that story in different forms. We're getting it a lot. Yeah, we've literally had requests from all over the country. I mean, one of my graduate students, as we speak, is counting up states, but it's got to be, you know, 30 states or something. Now, it's really been, I mean, I think this really does speak to the power of oral history. We did a book tour with the book, as we did with the play, through affected neighborhoods, through the public library. And with both the book and the play, you know, even if we were speaking to fairly young audiences, we had Steppenwolf actors reading chapters from the book. And we had him not hold back on language or graphic descriptions at all. So the F-bomb has dropped a lot in this book just because that's the way people speak. And what it did was you could see some of their teachers squirming when these graphic descriptions of violence or language that wasn't allowed in the classroom was spoken. But what you could see with the kids was, okay, this is actually my world you're talking about. And so we had some really, really powerful moments during this book tour. In one library on the west side of Chicago, these adult learners came in, some of them illiterate. And one woman told a librarian afterwards that she was so moved by the book that her goal now was to get to be a good enough reader where she could read the whole book. She wanted that to be the first book she read. So for me, what's been exciting about this is I'm used to having my work read by book people. My first books sold really well and sold a bunch of international editions, but it's sort of about books, so the people reading it were bibliophiles, and it was great to hear from them. This book is, you know, 180 degrees different. The exciting thing is to hear from people who aren't book people who say, "Your book has an impact on me."
So it sounds like, as you self-proclaimed about halfway through this as a middle-aged white guy, that this was a transformative event for you, too.
Yeah, no, it really has been, and I think that's the power of collaborative storytelling, of stepping back as auteur, you know, as the guy who does everything. And of course, I've had my hand in a very large way in on every step of this. You know, I wrote the play, I edited the book, when I edited every story in the book, but I had such, I don't even want to say help, such collaboration from my students, from people at DePaul, and from people at Steppenwolf, and from the narrators in the book. One of the things my students talked me into, one of the decisions they were just very firm about, was that they wanted the narratives to go back to the people we interviewed before they went in the book. And as a journalist, I was just very skeptical about that. You know, we get trained in journalism school, you don't show a source a story before it runs. You should fact check it, but you don't send it to them. You don't send a story about President Obama to President Obama and say, can you approve this? But my students just convinced me that because these were these people's stories told in their own words, that we needed to bring them in as creative collaborators. And my worst fears were not realized. People weren't saying, oh my God, I can't believe I said that, get rid of that. They were saying, wow, you know, that section where I talked about the gun, your student never asked me about this, but here's a detail that might be really interesting to you there. In most cases, these people were true collaborators, and the cool thing is they can truly now claim authorship. So when we did the book tour through libraries, we had Steppenwolf actors read, and then we had real people from the book there who would get up and talk. And then they were the ones who did the book signings afterwards, and that was just awesome for me. I just thought, how cool, and I thought, in a real way, they are the authors of these stories. Not that I didn't have a role, not that my students didn't have a massive role, but these are their stories, and it's their stories that are helping other people sort through this mess of youth violence.
Miles, I promise to give you some space here at the end if there are other things you want to talk about. So is there anything else you want to add?
I'm really grateful to be interviewed on this forum. I think too often in academia, there are people doing interesting things in different lines of work, in different buildings, in different disciplines, and I do think we need to be respectful of each other and respectful, but I also think that oral history is such a powerful form that my students and I, it may have taken us a little bit longer to learn it than some students who are in oral history programs, but I am really proud of the work they did, and I'm really grateful to be on this forum and be able to talk about it.
Miles Harvey, you are the editor of How Long Will I Cry? Voices of Youth Violence. Again, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm really grateful to be on.
And for information about the book, you should go to BigShouldersBooks.com, where you can find out about the book and order a copy.